not to be raining. But anyway, we're so excited to have Lynn come up and share with us, one of our own, but definitely somebody we all look up to. You know, to be honest, I think about it so many times. I don't know if, yeah, you know, Pastor Mike already got us started, so here we go. So I kind of knew going into this that this was going to be like this. Parang kakayanin ba natin to? But how many of you know this is good? Because this is why we do this, eh? And so many times we forget. And I think more and more we need to realize that we rely so much on Pastor Steve, the apostolic team, to cultivate this for us. But the reality is, we need to now recognize that we are the ones cultivating this mission and this vision and this culture to our team. And the more we get this, the better for us and the better for the ministry as a whole, because the reality is vision leaks. Bill Hybels said that in his book, and I realize it's so true. I mean, I hook, line, and sinker believe everything we're hearing, but every so often, the reality of this world will choke even that from my own heart. And so every so often, we need this. And Lynn is somebody who I really look up to as somebody who lives out this vision. I mean, when we think about the poor, we think about what we're doing here. The truth is, it's so easy for our hearts to just get hard. And I mean, you live in a world where poverty is normal. Your eyes just gloss over it and you forget. And at a certain point, you no longer see it. And for somebody who is Japanese Canadian, you know, you think about every nation, you think of her, you know, to be honest. But for her to choose our country as her mission field to do the thing that God's called her to do, and for God to allow her regularly to break her heart again and again for our nation, I think it'll do well for all of us to allow God to do that same work in us for a little bit. Okay, so can we give Lynn a very, very big hand? We're ready. I'll get tissue. Here we go.
Thanks, Carlos. I've been psyching myself up all morning, but no guarantee since since I did start crying while I was preparing this last night, so I was like, okay. But yeah. Good morning, everyone. I'm actually really honored to have this opportunity to speak to you all. When I was preparing this morning, I was thinking like, gosh, I'm not usually this nervous to speak about, you know, this kind of a topic that I'm comfortable with, but it's because, you know, you guys are all my peers, and I really do appreciate this opportunity. And I was telling Jack yesterday, I only actually got the title of my session about 7 p.m. last night when Jack emailed it to me. So the last slide I made was my title, but I'm actually, you know, really so happy and really appreciate this opportunity to be able to share with you today. And I think, you know, real life is a very different sort of department from most of the other ministries, because, you know, I love the preaching that Pastor Steve shared last year in our Metro Manila staff meeting about, you know, he said, you know, people come in, they look at this building and they say like, wow, you guys, you know, are a rich church. But he said, you know, remember how we started. Victory started with three things. We started, you know, to reach the lost, to reach the youth, and to reach the poor back in 1984. And he said, we're still doing that. We're reaching the lost through missions and church planting. We're reaching the youth through Lifebox, and we're reaching the poor through Real Life Foundation. But the difference is, we've been doing missions in campus for almost 28 years. We've been doing Real Life for 4.5 years. And so Real Life really is the baby of the, you know, of our family, of our ministry family here. So I'm actually not going to speak very much about Real Life, but I'm going to use this as an opportunity to do a teaching on what is Compassion Ministries and how do we go about it. And so the first thing is, I have a pop question for you, and Carlos and Edwin can't answer this, but okay, who can quickly grab a mic and tell me the mission statement of Every Nation Ministries? The mission of every nation, of which we are all a part. Anyone? Any brave souls want to venture a try? No one? Oh, Addo, give it a try. All right, so can someone pass him a microphone, please?
Honor God and establish Christ-centered, Spirit-empowered, socially responsible churches and and campus ministries in every nation.
Yeah, I just turned it off. I just turned it off after it stopped working. You know, I always ask people and remind them about that because, you know, even though, you know, obviously victory is a lot easier to remember, you know, honor God, make disciples, but we are all a part of every nation. And as Addo said, our mission statement as every nation is to honor God by establishing Christ-centered, Spirit-empowered, socially responsible churches and campus ministries in every nation. And so it's something that we often ask senior pastors, campus ministers, is like, you know, in what way or how are you going about being socially responsible? And that ties us into the topic today, which is what is compassion ministries? And I'm going to start with you know, a statement here that says, the task of God's people is rooted in Christ's mission. Simply stated, Jesus preached the good news of the kingdom in word and in deed. So the church must do the same. So, you know, a lot of times we can get so caught up with, you know, yes, we're called to preach the gospel. Yes, we want to, you know, we want to see people get saved. But when you look at the life of Jesus, you know, he didn't just say, okay, you need to be saved and that's it. You look at what he did. Jesus was constantly reaching out to the poor, to the sick, and the lost. He was constantly healing people. He was constantly going to where the poor people were and, you know, reaching out to them. And, you know, we all know this verse, but in Matthew 25, 36 to 40, it says, then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? The king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. And so this is, you know, it's very clear here that, you know, there's an expectation that not just, you know, get saved and go to heaven and, you know, we all have a good time. But, you know, Jesus also commanded us to, you know, to do something while we're here on earth. And part of that is compassion ministries. Part of that is, you know, when you read the Bible, I'm always, you know, just so amazed by how many verses, how many scriptures there are in both Old Testament and New Testament that talk about God's heart for the poor, God's heart for widows and orphans, God's heart for the oppressed, God's heart for those people, you know, who are worn down, who are beaten down, who are, you know, distressed. And, you know, that really is the heart of God. And, you know, Carlos was referencing the, you know, that quotation that I like to share from The Hole in Our Gospel, which is from the founder of World Vision, Bob Pierce. And, you know, he said, you know, he would always pray to God, break my heart for what breaks, you know, the heart of God. And, you know, and I really believe that is what compassion is. Compassion is being able to see people through the eyes of God, see people the way God sees them. You know, God doesn't see a sinner. God sees somebody who needs to know Jesus Christ and who needs to be reconciled to him. God doesn't see, you know, a street person or a homeless person or some, you know, taong grasa that's just, you know, is lying on the street. God sees somebody whose life is broken and who needs to be restored. And, you know, I have a question here, and I said, you know, what is poverty? And I'm not looking for a dictionary definition here, but just, you know, from where you are, just shout out, what are the things that you think about when you hear the question, what is poverty? Mm-hmm. Yeah, hunger, poor, lack. Anything else? Bondage, yeah. A lot of times, you know, when we think about poverty, our first thought and, you know, what the world will tell you is the definition of poverty, usually is material poverty. We think about they lack the basic necessities of life, you know, proper shelter, proper nutrition, basic, you know, access to healthcare, education, clothing, you know, those are the things that we think of naturally. There's lack of money, lack of food, you know, lack of resources, lack of access to resources. But what I want to talk about today is, you know, a holistic understanding of poverty and how, you know, how we can do poverty alleviation. So I'm going to share four principles of compassion ministries. And the first one is that poverty is spiritual and relational, not just material. If we reduce people to just the physical, our poverty alleviation efforts will focus on material solutions. If you think about the U.S. is a very rich country, but they have millions and millions of poor people. And what's their answer? Welfare. You're poor, I'll just give you money. Does it make them any less poor? No, it just makes them more dependent on the government. They just expect the government to solve all their problems. But because the government is only looking at it from a material point of view, and they think, oh, their problem is they don't have enough money, we'll just give them money. But it doesn't solve the problem. And if you look at the history of the poor in America, I mean, the number of poor is just expanding exponentially, and it's actually scary if you look at it. And, you know, so we have to look at people as being not just physical, but people are spiritual, social, psychological, and physical beings. And so if we consider all of these things, then our approach and our efforts will be more holistic. And so this, you know, a good example of this is on the next slide. If, you know, how we think about the, you know, what we consider the cause of poverty will determine how we try to address it. So if we think that, well, people are poor because they lack knowledge, they're ignorant, they, you know, or they never got a chance to go to school. So the answer, okay, let's give them education. If we think it's because of oppression, then we'll get involved in social justice. If we think it's due to personal sin, then, you know, the answer is evangelism and discipleship. If we think it's lack of material things, again, provide greater access to material things. And so none of these are wrong, but none of these in isolation will address the root cause of poverty. And so again, it's, you know, a lot of times it's easy for us to focus on one thing as opposed to really thinking what is actually the root cause of poverty. So the second principle is that we are all fallen individuals with broken relationships. And, you know, obviously it's interesting because when you start to look at, you know, sin and the results of the fall and what it means, you know, to, it's, and it's not just to, in terms of material poverty, but if you can go to the next slide, please. You know, oh, if you can get the lines to show up. Oh, it doesn't show up? Okay. You can see it on your, you can see it on your handout here. Okay, what this, this is a very interesting slide that is very commonly in use in Christian NGO and social work circles. And basically what this shows is that, you know, here's our poor little guy in the middle who's all sad. And but it's basically showing that here he is surrounded by broken relationships. He's got a broken relationship with God. He's got a broken relationship with himself. He's got a broken relationship with others and a broken relationship with the rest of creation. And, you know, this is, you know, such an incredibly powerful picture of what is poverty, because you can see just the impact of this. If you have a, you know, if your relationship with God is broken, if your relationship with yourself is broken, others and the rest of creation, I mean, that really is the picture of poverty, right? And so to look into this a little bit more in detail, some of the results of the fall. So the first one is poverty of spiritual intimacy. That's the broken relationship with God. Okay, so when we have poverty of spiritual intimacy, it can result in many things, denying God's existence, or a lot of people, well, they won't deny God's existence, but they will deny his authority. You know, who's really going to call the shots? Is it God or is it me? Another way it takes form is materialism or humanism. We see this a lot in the West, in Europe, in the United States, places like that, where, you know, what rules is, well, whatever works for me, you know, I just need to make money and be successful. Or in other cases, worshiping false gods, like in a place like India, or like what Pastor Michael was saying, in places like Thailand and Cambodia. Second is a poverty of being, and this is broken relationship with myself. And poverty of being can result in two different ways. One can be a God complex where, I have a distorted view of myself because I don't have a right view of God and my identity. So then I think that, okay, whatever I decide is correct, whatever I decide is right for me, and, you know, too bad for you if it's not what you think. And or the opposite end of that is a sense of shame or inferiority. And we'll go into this a little bit more in a minute, but essentially, you know, a God complex is more common in the non-poor, and a sense of shame inferiority is more common in the poor. The third result of the fall is poverty of community. And this one, again, very self-evident, self-centeredness, exploitation. exploitation and abuse, you know, sometimes you look at, you know, people who do things like, you know, human trafficking or, you know, slavery, people who run prostitution rings and things like that, and you think like, how can people, you know, abuse and exploit human beings in that way? And yet, again, if you've cut off that relationship, if you have a broken relationship with your community, then you don't care because, hey, it's all about, you know, I'm going to do what's good, the best for me. And if it hurts you, if it exploits you, if it takes advantage of you, well, you know, that's your problem, because, you know, that's that kind of a person has totally cut off their connection to community. And then lastly, poverty of stewardship. And that's broken relationship with the rest of creation. And we see this in a loss of sense of purpose, laziness, or on the other side, workaholism, and also, you know, the ground is cursed. It's hard to get, you know, it's hard to make a living. You're striving. Resources are dwindling. Environment is failing, and yet, you know, it's still hard. And so, when we look at the, you know, what is behind all of this, you know, you look at this and you think this is, you know, this is a very over. It's overwhelming when you look at it this way. You think, wow, all these broken relationships. And really, relationships are broken due primarily, this isn't a comprehensive list, but primarily the ones that we're going to focus on are individual sin, a faulty worldview concerning God, yourself, others, and the rest of creation, as we've seen, and broken systems at local, national, and international levels. And the poor typically have little control over these. So, you know, yes, sometimes we see, okay, the system is corrupt, but that is not the root cause of poverty. It exacerbates poverty, but that's not the root cause. Or, you know, faulty worldview. Okay, it's a, you know, we're in a communist system, we're in a Hindu system, we're in a caste system. Yes, you know, that will definitely affect you and make life a lot more difficult for you. But again, you know, that is not the root cause of poverty. So we have to look at all of these things in their entirety. And if we're really gonna understand, you know, what is poverty and how, what can we do to address it? And so when we look at it this way, if we're saying that, you know, poverty is, you know, these broken relationships with God, with myself, with others, and with the rest of creation. So, you know, then we have to ask ourselves, so who then are the poor? And the answer is, if poverty is rooted in broken relationships, every one of us is counted amongst the poor, because all of us have broken relationships to some extent or another. Some of us have less broken relationships, some have more, but, you know, this is really one of the most important starting points, is realizing that I am also poor. I also have broken relationships. Before I met Christ, I was one of the most broken individuals. You know, if I didn't have God in my life, you know, who knows where I would be now. And, you know, and you look at it and think, okay, poverty of self, okay, a poverty of being, you know, it's amazing. Like, all of you, I'm sure, have been in ministry situations, Victory Weekend, and you see the brokenness, you see the dysfunctional relationships, you see, you know, people that are very successful in life, and yet you see, in, you know, sense of shame, low self-esteem, all of these things that, you know, something that happened 20 years ago still controlling their lives today. And so we realize, okay, wow, all of us are still poor to some extent. All of us have broken relationships to some extent. And, you know, even community. Some people, you know, I know a girl, it's very sad. She loves God, but she's decided literally to cut herself off from community because she says, oh, you know, I went to this church and they were judgmental, and I went to this church and they were cliquish, and I went to this church, and you know the type, and, you know, find something wrong with every small group they go to, with every church they go to. So she's decided she'll stay home, listen to podcasts, and, you know, just be happy with herself. I know, it's very sad. But she's a Christian, she's born again, she loves God, but she has cut herself off from community. She has broken relationships with community. And I think it's easy for us to admit that many of us have broken relationships with the rest of creation. You know, how good a steward are we of our environment and this type of thing. So I'm not going to go into that because that's not critical to what we're doing. But again, the point here is that until we embrace the fact that we ourselves also have broken relationships, that our attempts to help the poor may do more harm than good. And so this leads us into principle number 3, which is This is one working definition of poverty. Again, there are many, but this is from Walking with the Poor. Brian Myers is one of the, he's executive vice president for strategy for World Vision. And he said, poverty is a result of relationships that do not work, that are not just, that are not for life, that are not harmonious or enjoyable. And so that's a very different definition than we normally think of when we think of what is poverty. And so, again, I don't know, this probably also won't show up on here, but we're going to look particularly at poverty of being, because, you know, poverty of spiritual intimacy, obviously we all know that, that's why we make disciples and share the gospel. But we're going to look first at poverty of being, because this is what comes into play when we as individuals or as organizations or as churches, in our efforts to help the poor and to do compassion ministries. So when we talk about poverty of being in the poor, normally we look at shame and inferiority. Shame is a major part of the brokenness that low-income people experience in their relationship with themselves. Instead of seeing themselves as being created in the image of God, they often feel they are inferior to others. And it's interesting, I just got back from trips to Gensan and Bacolod to visit our real-life programs there. And I got to meet the new incoming scholars who just got qualified as new scholars for June. And I also met our existing scholars, some of whom are graduating next month or this month. And it's so amazing because when you meet the new incoming, especially high school students, I mean, they can't even look you in the eye. You know, you say like, hi, I'm Lynn. They're like, wow. And it's amazing. And then you see the ones that have been with us for, 3 or 4 years or graduating. They're like, hi, beso, beso. And they're like giving me hugs. They're so confident. I was so impressed with our scholars in Gensan. I visited the youth service on Friday night at Victory Gensan. Our scholars, they preach. They do the transition and the offering. They're the ushers. They're the technical support. They do the same thing Saturday morning in a community service for the CCT moms who receive microloans. Sunday morning, they run the 9 a.m. Children's Church. They're really such leaders. And it's funny because one of our scholars was scheduled to preach at the youth service Friday night, but when he heard I was going to be there, he begged off for another week because he didn't think he could do it if I was there. But they really speak so well, and I was just so impressed. I was talking about it with our area coordinators. It's just, just so incredible the transformation you see. Someone who comes in and can't even look you in the eye, and then, after being discipled and mentored and really coming to understand their identity in Christ. I mean, they literally are transformed beings. But this is really, something that we deal with a lot when you're dealing with poverty of being, because there's just, especially when someone doesn't have a job, it takes away their sense of dignity, especially like for, a father or a husband, head of a household, and, you don't have a job, you're not bringing any income. It really is a crushing blow to the dignity of a human, because we were meant to work. God designed us and created us to with a purpose, and designed us to be stewards, to be productive stewards. And so this is something that we really have to address. But again, there's equally poverty of being in the non-poor, and this is when the economically rich also suffer from a poverty of being. They often have a God complex, a subtle and an unconscious sense of superiority in which they believe they are better able to decide what is best for low-income people. And it's interesting because, we see this a lot in our feeding program, and I'm always the bad guy in our feeding program because, we have all these very well-meaning, generous people, especially from church, that come and they say, oh, I want to give toys to all the children. And I say, oh, thank you, but I don't allow that. And they're like, but why? I have a toy store, and it's nothing, and I just want to give these. And I say, this is a nutrition program. And secondly, we don't want them to see us as Santa. We're not Santa Claus. And thirdly, it takes away from the dignity of the parents. If you're constantly giving them toys and, clothes and things like that, and then, the poor mom is saying, like, the kid's like, how come you never give me toys? How come you never give me candy? How come you never give me cupcakes? And, you know, you have to be very sensitive that you're not, destroying the dignity of the parents and their ability to provide for their child. It's different when it's basic nutrition, because any parent wants better nutrition for their child, and they understand that. But if you start throwing around toys and, you know, this type of thing, there, you know, again, it's very, you know, it's a very subtle thing, but it's like, oh, but I would want this for my child. No, but this isn't your child, you know. And we can even have God complexes in a spiritual sense. And you know, I want to share a story for you from this. If you're interested in this material, I highly recommend this book. It's referenced at the very end. It's called When Helping Hurts. And even this has a very good chapter also about cross-cultural missions, and also about doing disaster and relief work. And but they share a story here about visiting a slum in Africa. But when they describe the slum, this could very easily be Smoky Mountain. This could be Tatalan. This could be Baseko. And so I'm just going to read this story. So this is one of the authors. So he goes to this slum in Africa, and then he hears people. He hears like a church service in the middle of the squatter area. So he's like, oh, what's this? So, you know, they peek in. And then he said, I listened to some of the poorest people on the planet cried out to God, Jehovah Jireh, please heal my son as he is going blind. Merciful Lord, please protect me when I go home today, for my husband always beats me. Sovereign King, please provide my children with enough food today as they are hungry. As I listened to these people praying to be able to live another day, I thought about my ample salary, my life insurance policy, my health insurance policy, my two cars, my house, etc. I realized that I do not really trust in God's sovereignty on a daily basis, as I have sufficient buffers in place to shield me from most economic shocks. I realize that when these folks pray the fourth petition of the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread, their minds do not wander as mine so often does. I realize that while I have sufficient education and training to deliver a sermon on God's sovereignty with no forewarning, these slum dwellers were trusting in God's sovereignty just to get them through the day. And I realize that these people had a far deeper intimacy with God than I probably will ever have in my entire life. And so, I mean, that's such a powerful story, because this American pastor, he goes through the slums in Africa and thinking, oh, I'm here to help you people. I'm here to, you know, show you the way. And then, you know, God just totally convicts him and shows him that these people have a deeper relationship with God than you, because they literally have to cry out to God every single day and trust him just to stay alive, just to put one meal on the table for their family. You know, and I was thinking about this, and I said, you know, imagine if it were your own child, and you know, your child got sick, and you can't take them to the doctor because you don't have money, you can't buy them medicine because you don't have money. And we see that very often with our scholars. You know, they'll get a very serious, you know, sickness or illness or disease, and they don't see a doctor because they don't have money, they don't have health insurance. And you know, it's the reality of every day for millions of people. And you know, and so when you see this, you realize, you know, and it's something that really has struck me also when I meet our scholars and the families of our scholars, is, you know, these people know God because they have to. They literally rely on God for every single thing in their lives. And it really humbles me to know that, you know, gosh, I have it so easy. I'm so lazy sometimes that I'm, you know, I forget to pray. And, you know, because I can do that. I've got the luxury of, you know, being able to be lax in my prayer life. Whereas these people, you know, prayer is their, literally, it's a lifeline. It's a lifeline for them. And so, you know, when again, looking at material poverty, if we're just going to have a material definition of poverty, we see here that if we have a God complex in the non-poor and feelings of inferiority of the materially poor, the result can be harm to both the poor and the non-poor. And so, again, you know, this is one thing that we try very carefully to, you know, to protect ourselves against and to avoid in real life. And like Pastor Michael was saying earlier, the by the grace of God, somehow we always seem to stumble on being able to do things the right way. And I'm the same way, like you were saying, you know, I'll be reading books like this, like, oh, wow, we're actually doing things the right way. That's good to know. You know, there's actually a practical basis and theory, you know, theoretical basis for, you know, why we're doing what we're doing and this type of thing. But it's, you know, it really is just the grace of God that we're able to, you know, to do these because, you know, like he was saying that, earlier, there's sometimes where you really think, okay, God, are we doing the right thing? And I remember when I was interviewing Vince for the job of the program director for scholarships, you know, he said, I only have one concern. He said, I don't feel like I'm qualified for this job. And I said, Vince, none of us are qualified for this. And I said, I'm certainly not qualified for what I'm doing. I said, it's purely by the grace of God. And I said, it's probably a good thing because otherwise I'd rely on my own ability. Whereas since I know I'm not qualified for this job, I have to rely on God and always like, Holy Spirit, help. And so, you know, again, what I was describing in the my illustration with the feeding program is what they call paternalism. And the reason that we need to avoid paternalism is resource paternalism is giving the poor things they already have or don't need. Labor paternalism is doing for the poor what they can do for themselves. Managerial paternalism is making decisions or running programs for them that they are capable of doing for themselves. So again, you know, sometimes the God complex in the non-poor can result in them feeling like, okay, you know, because I always say, okay, they're poor, they're not helpless. And, you know, because sometimes your brain automatically thinks like, oh, we need to do this for them. We need to provide this for them. And, you know, we've had several instances with our scholars where, you know, somebody had a need, say, for an OJT that was like three times as expensive as all the rest of our OJTs, or, you know, someone needs to get a camera for their fine arts course, or somebody needs a suit for their OJT in a hotel. And then, so they were asking, you know, well, we need 4,000 for this, or we need 5,000 for this. And then, you know, sometimes, you know, my staff would say, oh, okay, like, this, you know, we need to give them this, or they need money for youth camp, or for kids' church, you know, teachers' camp. And I'd say, okay, first of all, kids' church and youth camp have nothing to do with real life, because we're an educational scholarship fund. But even if it's OJT or a suit, I said, you know, These kids are smart, they have resources, they're resourceful, they have connections. I said, you know, why don't we challenge their faith and say, why don't you try, you know, pray and ask God to help you to raise the funds that you need. And, you know, it's, again, you don't, if you just hand them the money, they'll never learn to trust in God and to rely on their own resources. Again, some of our provincial scholars, they started saving, you know, 6 months or not even 8 months ahead when they found out that we're having a national scholars conference. They're saving a portion of their weekly allowance every week so that they can buy their own plane tickets to come here in end of October for our national scholars conference. And so, you know, again, sometimes we have to challenge them and, you know, give them that sense of dignity and that sense of really achievement that I know I can do it. I don't need a handout. I just need opportunities. I just need a little help. And so we need to make sure that we're not being paternalistic in our attitudes towards the poor. Okay, next. So when we look at this, what is God's plan? And again, if we look at the creation, the fall, redemption, restoration, the problem, as we said, as a result of the fall, all humans are beset by broken relationships, and the answer, as we know, is Jesus Christ came to bring restoration. So the fourth principle, material poverty alleviation, is working to reconcile the four foundational relationships so that people can fulfill their callings of glorifying God by working and supporting themselves and their families with the fruit of that work. So again, we see here that it's not just about giving people money, it's not giving handouts, it's not just, you know, taking care of them, it's really empowering them to be able to do what God has created them to do and allowing them to stand on their own two feet and be productive stewards. So again, material poverty alleviation is more than just ensuring that people have enough things or enough, you know, money. Rather, it involves a much harder task of empowering people to earn sufficient material things through their own labor, and in so doing, help them fulfill the purpose God created them for. And so, you know, that's why for Real Life Foundation, our mission is to honor God by serving the poor and empowering their dreams. Because that really is our ultimate goal, is we want to empower them to be able to, first of all, you know, to know Christ and be have their lives transformed by Christ, and so that they can glorify God by fulfilling His purpose for their lives. And so it's not just about, you know, again, it's not just about, okay, you don't have enough money, I'm going to give you money. It's, you know, what has God created you to do? And we want to help to see you achieve that. And, you know, it's interesting because I'm going to embarrass Jack here, but the I always find it really funny that when I tell pastors that, you know, Jack is a Real Life Scholar alumni, they're like, Jack was a scholar? And, you know, the reason they're always so astonished is because, you know, Jack is empowered. Jack is fulfilling God's purpose for his life. He's not, you know, he's not walking around with his head down like he's, even though he's, yeah, Jack never hides, even though he's trying to hide under the table right now. But, you know, it's the same thing. Mimi, who was here earlier helping Pastor Michael, Mimi is a Real Life Scholar alumni. Fern and Faye in our finance department are Real Life Scholar alumni. You know, it's, you know, it's amazing because you look at these people. Tony Aguilar in Lifebox is a Real Life alumni. And you look at these people and you would never in a million years think that they came from an impoverished background, because they know their identity in Christ, and they're empowered, and they're fulfilling, you know, they know that they're fulfilling God's purpose for their lives. And so, you know, that's why I get such a kick out of it when people are, they're always so shocked. Like, they just, you know, they think I'm joking when I say that, yeah, you know, Jack was a scholar, you know, Fern and Mimi and all these guys. And, you know, they even June in EMP. And so, you know, but that's what happens when you're fulfilling God's purpose for your life. Yes, June Ong is also a Real Life alumni. I saw Edwin like, June? She was from our very first graduating class of Real Life Scholars, June DeClaro Ong. Okay, so again, if we look at poverty alleviation principles, the goal of poverty alleviation is not just having wealth or more material things. The goal is for each person to be living rightly in all four of the key relationships. And so, again, we see our little guy finally released from all his bondage, and he's happy now. And his relationships have been restored. He's got a relationship with God. He has a good relationship with himself, healthy relationship with others, and with the rest of creation. So, ultimately, the reconciliation of the key relationships that comprise poverty alleviation cannot be done without people accepting Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. And I have a verse here, Colossians 1, 19 and 20. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Yeah. So I'm ending here by saying, what then must we do? So again, another very famous verse, but I share it here, 1 John 3, 16 to 18. We know what real love is because Jesus gave up his life for us. We also ought to give up our lives for our brothers and sisters. If someone has enough money to live well and sees a brother or sister in need but shows no compassion, how can God's love be in that person? Dear children, let's not merely say that we love each other. Let us show the truth by our actions. So there's two possible responses to 1 John 3, 17 and 18. The first response, which, you know, we've often heard in the past, is, well, the job of the church is to evangelize and disciple people. Helping the poor is the job of the government and NGOs. The second response is, helping the poor is part and parcel of the ministry of reconciliation and is everyone's job, including yours and mine. And so the conclusions here, I'm going to show a short video after this, so that's why I'm rushing. Christians need to be doing more, not less. It is essential that frontline staff are Christians because we have the answer, which is the message of the gospel. Because again, everything starts with restoring the relationship to God so that they can then restore the relationship with themselves, with others, and the rest of creation. And we can serve the poor with confidence, again, not in ourselves, but in our Redeemer, Jesus Christ, because we know that It is really only by His grace that all of us are here, and therefore we can extend that grace to others. So the last verse here is Isaiah 58, 6 and 7, and it says, "Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen, to loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe them and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood. Then your light will break forth like the dawn and your healing will quickly appear. Then your righteousness will go before you and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. So on that note, I want to show you, this is about a just under an 8-minute video, but it's a really powerful video that sort of sums up everything I've shared, and then I'll close after the video.
I mean, the statistics are overwhelming. 164,000 children died of measles in a single year. 881,000 people were killed by malaria. 1.4 billion people struggle to live in extreme poverty. That's surviving on less than $1.25 per day. But you know, measles doesn't kill people. Malaria doesn't kill people. A lack of food or clean water, they don't kill people. Even most natural disasters, they rarely kill people. There is one single killer responsible for all of these deaths: extreme poverty. Poverty is the difference between a $5 latte with an extra shot or a $5 shot that will protect a child from dying of measles. Poverty is the difference between an earthquake in Los Angeles killing 63 people and an earthquake of similar magnitude in Haiti killing 220,000 people. Wherever poverty has a stronghold, the statistics are grim. I recently spoke at a pastor's conference. I asked these church leaders, these pastors, to write down one verse, the first verse that came to their mind about poverty or about the poor. You want to guess what the most common answer was? "The poor will always be with you." Jesus said those words right after Mary poured a $45,000 jar of perfume on his feet. And Judas, you know, Judas Iscariot, the greedy little treasurer, he saw that money dripping on the floor, dripping on that dirt, and he objected and he said, "Why this waste? This perfume could have been sold and the money given to the poor. It was worth a year's wages." So Jesus then turns to Judas, the keeper of the purse, and he says, "You'll always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me." Well, wait a second, let's look at that again. You will not always have me? We will not always have Jesus? But later he says, "I will be with you always." Which is it? We know the answer. How can we treat the first half of this sentence like an all-time proclamation and we put the second half in context? I mean, who is the you? Jesus didn't say the poor would always be with us. Jesus didn't somehow ordain economic poverty because he wasn't talking to us. He was talking to Judas. When Jesus prayed, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven," it wasn't some cliche fit for a greeting card. It was his driving ambition for his kingdom. And God does not want people to suffer in economic poverty. God does not intend for people to die of preventable diseases. God clearly and repeatedly has commanded us to care for the poor, and God has given us everything we need to end extreme poverty. Here is the astounding truth: the tyranny of extreme poverty is being broken. In the past 8 years, the number of kids dying from measles has dropped by 78%. 22 countries have cut their malaria rate in half, and they did it in only 6 years. You know, we used to say that 40,000 children die every day from preventable causes. In the 90s, that number dropped from 40,000 to 33,000 per day, and in 2008, it dropped again to 24,000, and now we're down to 21,000. We cut that number in half in a generation. I'd like to take you back 200 years to 1810. We had an average lifespan of 30 years, and almost all of us were living in extreme economic poverty, but things begin to change. Industrialization starts to happen in Europe, and the economies are growing, and as they're making more money, they're able to secure more quality food, and they're living longer, they're living healthier. And in that time, we discover electricity, and we invent the automobile, and airplanes, and vaccines, and soon the rest of the world is following. And as you look across that whole span of time, you see this momentum, the sense that we are heading somewhere. Even those countries that we look at today and think, "Oh, it's just not possible," they are all following this path out of extreme poverty and into a new place. You remember that massive number that I gave you earlier, the number of people living in extreme poverty, 1.4 billion? Well, listen to this. I mean, if you're only going to remember one set of numbers from all this stuff I'm telling you, remember this. 52 to 26 and 26 to go. In 1981, 52% of the world's population lived in extreme poverty. Today, that number is 26%. We've cut the percentage of people living in extreme poverty in half, and we did it in a generation. If that's what the generation before ours did, just imagine what our generation can do. There are 138 million Christians in America who attend church regularly and say their faith is very important to them. Collectively, we earn $2.5 trillion per year. We would be the seventh richest country in the world. If we were a country, we'd have a seat at the G8. God has given us amazing wealth and influence. Question is, what are we going to do with it? What could we do with it? You know, in Isaiah 58, we find God's people. They are trying, no, they're begging to receive blessings from the Lord. But they're exploiting their workers, and they're fighting with each other. They're bickering. And they're complaining that their sacrifices haven't been noticed by God and that their fasting has been overlooked. But Isaiah, the prophet, he steps into that and he says, you want God to honor your sacrifices? Well, this is what you need to do. It's time to loose the chains of injustice. It's time to set the oppressed free. I believe the message of Isaiah 58 is the same message that we need to hear again today. No more idle words. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of men willing to be co-workers with God. It's time for authentic action. Let's stop performing out of religious habits and start living the life we were called to. The poor will not always be with us. We do not need to live in a world where children die from preventable diseases. Extreme poverty and all the suffering it brings can be pushed into the history books. And God has given us the mandate and every resource that we need to accomplish that task. He has entrusted us with money, with knowledge, with influence, and with a brief amount of time on this earth, a brief amount of time in which to make a difference. Ending extreme poverty is our generation's greatest opportunity to join the ranks of those who fought for the end of the slave trade, to stand with those who worked for equal rights in the generations before ours. And we are asking you to join this march, not because you need to, not from duty, not out of guilt, not with any reluctance, but because you want to, because you were made for this.
The power of video, huh? What I love about this video is when the first time I saw this, it really convicted me because I realized it's true. We're trapped by the tyranny of our own low expectations. We've grown up seeing so much poverty around us and just seeing like, oh, it's always going to be like that. That's never going to change. Those people will never get a job. Those people, it's always going to be like this. But, you know, that's why... You know, one of the things that we did last year was we changed the vision statement of Real Life Foundation. And our vision statement is now transforming lives, families, and communities through hope and education. Because obviously education is the vehicle. We're an education program. We do scholarships. But without hope, I mean, hope to me is really the key. That is, you know, you cannot do it without hope. And, you know, where does our hope come from? Our hope comes from God. And, you know, that's why when I see this video, I get so stirred up because I realize, you know, we can believe for this. I was researching last night. There are 50 million Filipinos living in extreme poverty. That's less than $2 a day. But is it any different to live on $3 a day? That's still extreme poverty by almost anyone's definition. And if you raise it to $3 a day, it's probably 70 million. And so, you know, again, if our goal is to reach this nation for the glory of God, we have to reach the poor. And so the other thing I love about that video is, you know, we don't, you know, I always tell people, You know, our faith is that people will really rally around this cry, and like he said, not out of any sense of obligation. I mean, I love what the Catholic Church does, because they do impart and teach in their people, you know, to do to do good deeds for the poor, right? But I don't want anyone to do it out of obligation. I want them to do it because they want to. And so I'm going to leave you with a challenge. And my challenge to you, I always present after this material, is in light of what you've learned today, how is God calling you to respond? Thank you.
Wow. I'm going to sit down and talk to Paul Barker to see if we can get this into the pastor's program, Lynn. No, seriously. I think if it's one thing of the ministries that we are about, and I appreciate Lynn starting off with the Every Nation mission statement, because it is there and it is true. And really, you know, we don't talk about it a lot because we just assume we get it. But since the beginning of this ministry, we've always been very involved in compassion ministry, whether that's relief efforts in practical ways or, you know, medical missions of some program. And we've really taken that seriously in recent, in this last decade, in trying to figure out how can we really seriously do this. And so we started a program in Inalay. At the time, it was just an experiment of some form because we had so many in Pasig. We had to do something. And that's what eventually birthed Real Life Foundation. So what I love is that she didn't focus on Real Life Foundation because that's the practical thing our organization's doing. But the reality is all of us have to capture the heart behind what birthed Real Life. Because in the future, we foresee compassion ministry will have to take on more forms if we're serious about, you know, really ministering Christ into the communities that we're in. Okay? So the food is there. We're going to take